If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
It's hard not to add a side of hot, crispy hash browns to your favorite McDonald's breakfast. It's even harder not to eat said hash browns before you get home. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble. With exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello, I'm Rob Attar, and this is the first History Extra podcast of April 2012. This week, we're marking 30 years since the start of the Falklands War. Coming up on the programme, we have...
And all my old friends I've been war corresponding with in the Middle East, in Vietnam, in Africa, said, oh, come on, all that's going to happen, Max, you will sail round and round the Atlantic for weeks and get horribly seasick, and nothing will happen.
That was Sir Max Hastings, who served as a war reporter during the conflict.
There's a sense that veterans have that they're now dispensable by a system that they've given everything for.
And that was Dr. Helen Parr, who is researching the impact of the war on the people involved. This podcast is brought to you by the team behind BBC History Magazine, which is Britain's best-selling history magazine. You can find us in all good newsagents and on subscription. There's more details of that on our website, historyextra.com. Of course, we're now far more than just a print product. You can purchase our Kindle edition direct from the Amazon website, or try us out on the iPad via the Apple Newsstand. You can also find out more about our iPad edition at historyextra.com/iPad. Don't forget, we can also be found on facebook.com/historyextra or twitter.com/historyextra. On the 2nd of April 1982, Argentine forces invaded the Falkland Islands, which are known in Argentina as the Malvinas. In response, Margaret Thatcher's government in Britain ordered that a task force be sent to the South Atlantic to claim them back. After a successful two-month campaign, the Argentines surrendered and the war was over, at a cost of over 900 lives. One man who witnessed the fighting firsthand was Sir Max Hastings, a journalist and historian who accompanied the British task force as a war correspondent. On Sunday, he presented a BBC Two documentary on the Falklands legacy. I interviewed Max recently about his Falklands experiences and began by asking him about the documentary.
I'm doing a 60-minute special for BBC Two, which is really about the legacy of the Falklands, simply trying to look at how the war seems to us 30 years on, three decades on, after all the feelings at the time, and everybody said amazingly euphoric things about how this was going to transform Britain, and this was going to show that we were a new Britain and had left the past behind. And really, in a way, I think what seems to me striking is that the legacy of the Falklands was really quite short-lived. It was enormously important in making Margaret Thatcher that it's sometimes forgotten that back in 1982, when the war broke, Thatcher's standing in the opinion polls was very low. And many of us had real doubts whether she was going to win the 1983 general election. And her standing within her own party was very low. That many people were within the Conservative ranks were thinking openly about revolts, and the so-called wets, who hated her as much as she hated them, were bitterly hostile to a lot of things she was trying to do. Well, of course, the Falklands absolutely transformed all that. Suddenly she had an authority as a world statesman, that she was known all over the world, vastly admired in America as the Iron Lady and all the rest of it. So the Falklands War had a huge effect on Thatcher's fortunes and contributed significantly, if not decisively, to enabling her to win the 83 election. It also, of course, brought about democracy in Argentina, because the Argentine military junta collapsed as a result of defeat in the Falklands. But as for the rest, it gave a terrific boost to British self-confidence in the short term, that suddenly, after so long in which we'd all felt pretty glum about British decline, we suddenly found, well, even if we couldn't make a decent motor car, we could fight a jolly successful little colonial war. And that perked everybody up for a season. But then, when everybody calmed down and started looking at it more in perspective, that really, they did realise, we realised, that this little colonial war had absolutely nothing to do with the real problems of Britain in the last years of the 20th century. And in many ways, what's remarkable, I mean, for me, it was an extraordinary experience, and in many ways, perhaps the great romantic adventure of my life. But in its real strategic importance to Britain, its historical importance to Britain, I don't think its importance was that great.
In a way, it was more like the end of an era rather than a new beginning, because it was the last colonial war.
It was more like, I mean, I made a joke. All my friends teased me when I told them I was going to go to the Falklands, because I was then largely out of journalism, and I was writing a big book on D-Day and the Normandy campaign in World War II. And when I heard that Thatcher was sending a task force, I suddenly sat up and said, I've got to go. That most of my friends thought I was bonkers, and they said, Max, nobody's going to fight a war in the South Atlantic in 1982 for this completely meaningless bit of real estate in the middle of the South Atlantic. And all my old friends I'd been war corresponding with in the Middle East, in Vietnam, in Africa, said, oh, come on, all that's going to happen, Max, you will sail round and round the Atlantic for weeks and get horribly seasick, and nothing will happen. But I said, I always regretted that I wasn't around to go up the Nile with Kitchener in 1898 to fight the Dervishes, another great colonial adventure. But in our generation, to go by proxy at least to the South Atlantic with Thatcher seems the equivalent. And I felt, if there's going to be a war, it's going to be a quite extraordinary event, and I want to be there to see it. And I was a little bit nervous about my age, because I was 36. And although that may not sound very old to me now, I'm 65, but in those days it did seem pretty old, because we knew that if there was going to be a war in that bitterly hostile environment, and if we had to start walking, I mean, I'd never even heard the word yomping in those days, but if we had to start marching across the island, I was getting a bit old for marching with a pack across a barren hills on the other side of the world. But I felt, oh well, I may be just young enough to be able to get away with it. And so I packed up my old parachute smock and my boots and all the rest of it, and got on the boat at Southampton.
And you were saying that a lot of people didn't expect there to be a war over the Falklands. Why do you think Thatcher or Britain decided to go with the military option there?
Events have a momentum of their own, that it just inherently seems a matter of common sense, crazy, the idea that Britain in 1982 should actually come to blows with a South American state about this tiny place right in the middle of nowhere, inhabited by a couple of thousand settlers, at this stage in mankind's affairs. It just didn't seem to have anything to do with anything else. It had nothing to do with the Cold War, which of course was then going on with Russia. It had nothing to do with our huge industrial and economic problems. It was just an old-fashioned colonial conflict. But the Argentine junta never thought we would fight. Much later, when I started interviewing Argentine prisoners, they all said the same thing, but we never thought you would fight. We never thought you were serious. But Thatcher had got into a hell of a hole that everybody agreed, as they agree now, that the fact that Argentina had been able to invade the Falklands represented a colossal diplomatic and military humiliation for Britain, and especially for the Thatcher government. That really there have been two logical choices: either to negotiate for the Falklands if we didn't want them anymore, or to make sure we defended them. The worst possible option is what we did. We left the Argentines with the impression that we didn't really want the Falklands and we weren't serious about keeping them. And so we provided them with a rationale in their minds for invasion, and we did absolutely nothing to protect the islands from that contingency. So it was a huge failure by the Thatcher government that made possible what had happened. And after that, after Thatcher had taken a terrible hammering in the House of Commons, when she'd almost, you know, there was talk of national humiliation, of Britain looking ridiculous, of the Prime Minister looking ridiculous, she had to get them back if she was going to look credible any longer as Prime Minister. But the Argentines themselves, they couldn't believe that we were really, really going to fight a war at this stage to do it. A lot of people had great doubts whether it was possible. I mean, I've always been impressed, after the war was over and Simon Jenkins and I were writing a book together about it, I interviewed Sir Edwin Bramall, as he was then, who was the chief of the General Staff. And he made absolutely plain that he thought the idea of sending a task force was bonkers. He thought to fight a war at this stage in the game, 8,000 miles away, was going to be incredibly difficult with the resources we had. But he was bounced into it because the Royal Navy had told the Prime Minister they could do it. Why had they done that? Not because they really, really thought they could, but because Admiral Sir Henry Leach, who was then the first Sea Lord, when he was asked, he suddenly thought that all his years in the Navy, he'd seen the Navy declining and seemed to become ever more irrelevant, and suddenly he saw this, in his eyes, unique opportunity. At last, the Royal Navy had a chance to prove that it could still fight and it was still relevant. So he told Margaret Thatcher, without really thinking about the odds, that, yes, he could send a task force and we could recapture the islands. And so poor old General Bramall felt that after the Navy had said they could do it, the Army could hardly say they couldn't. But once this task force had put to sea, and once we were all unknowing in the middle of the South Atlantic, crowded aboard these ships, the people in charge started getting very cold feet. And when they started getting down some serious staff planning, Britain's three armed forces, for how we were going to recapture the islands, gosh, they were scared, because they could see how difficult this was going to be. Because there was the Argentines, who had their own aircraft carrier, who had air bases which they could reach the Falklands, and there was us with just a few Sea Harriers and our small aircraft carriers, and no, above all, no serious radar cover, which these days is thought absolutely essential to have proper radar cover, and we didn't have it. And so the people in charge on our side had very cold feelings in the pit of their stomachs as they started planning this. And the first thing they decided was, we've got to do something to improve the odds, which were very much against us. And it was because of that, it was because the Royal Navy saw the odds so heavily stacked, that they were so eager to sink at least one element of the Argentine fleet that was at sea. And their choice would have been to sink the Argentine aircraft carrier, which they thought posed the most dangerous threat. But the second most dangerous threat was the heavy cruiser Belgrano. And that was how the Belgrano came to be sunk. Because, of course, the government and the chiefs of staff couldn't say this publicly at the time, but they felt the odds were stacked against us and we had to do something to make them a bit better.
So the Belgrano did have a military use to the Argentines?
Oh, very much so. Oh, yeah. You know, it can't be said too often. In the eyes of the Royal Navy and the planners, as they looked at the whole situation when the campaign began, the Argentines had all the advantages. They were close to home, They had powerful forces. They had some jolly good aircraft. They had Exocet missiles. And we were on the back foot. And it was absolutely essential to improve the odds.
And so with the odds so much stacked against Britain, do you think it was quite a military achievement to be able to win the war?
The Argentines weren't very good. It's no good pretending they were. I mean, much later in the war, when I'd been with a Royal Marine commando who'd captured one of the mountains around Port Stanley, and he looked at this terrific mountain which the Argentines had been defending, and he said, with 50 Germans, I could have died of old age holding this place. And we shouldn't pretend that the Argentine army was the Wehrmacht. They were pretty pathetic. The real difficulty was fighting this campaign at such very long range, 8,000 miles from home. And the luck could have gone the other way. What we should never forget, our victory was not inevitable. All the Argentines that needed, they did have a good air force and they did have these good jets. And if one or two more of their bombs had worked, and if one or two more of their, if one of their exocets had hit a British aircraft carrier, as it well could have done, we could have found ourselves in a hell of a hole. But once we got ashore in the islands, the Royal Marines, the parachute regiment, were a million miles better than all these wretched Argentine conscripts. But I can tell you, I remember very well at the time how it felt. There we were when we got ashore in the Falklands on these barren islands, which looked pretty much like the west coast of Scotland. But gosh, it felt an awful long way from home. And we felt very lonely and very exposed. And when the Argentine aircraft started attacking, and we watched ships sinking, and I'd seen lots of things in my time as a war correspondent, but I'd never seen ships sinking. And when we looked out there and we saw ships going to the bottom in the middle of San Carlos water, we were scared. And we thought, I remember very well one day, after we'd just seen an air attack in which a couple of our transports had been hit, and a Royal Marine standing next to me said, "Gory," he said, "if it goes down like this, we're going to have to get the Yanks down here to help us." And I said, "I have to break it to you that the Americans are not going to come down and help us, that we're going to have to do this on our own." And it felt pretty lonely out there. And I mean, the climate, it was so cold and we were so wet and pretty glum stuff. And yeah, it was, I mean, the good bit, what made it a wonderful adventure for me, I grew not only to like, but to love those men one was with. I mean, they were terrific, Royal Marines of the Parrot. And when we started walking across this bloody island, and it was pretty rough, and certainly for me, it was not a young Marine or para. I was 36 years old and terribly unfit. That at times one felt pretty miserable, not to mention pretty cold. But with these terrific guys, you know, really, you just felt so lucky to be there with these wonderful men. And there was one terrific moment I remember when the commanding officer of the SAS, Michael Rose, agreed to take me up to the top of Mount Kent, which was then our most exposed position, miles out in the middle of nowhere, where we were staging a night landing. And I must say, I was bloody terrified that we take off. Before we took off, all these helicopters were hopelessly overloaded, and the SAS guys and a few Royal Marines got into them. Our flight of seeking. And then after we were in, everybody threw in on top of us lots of mortar bombs and blowpipe missiles and shells and ammunition boxes and all the rest of it. And I thought, gory, and I thought, if these are hit in the air, the chance of any of us getting out are almost nil. And then we set off. We're flying at deck level in the darkness across the Falklands to land in the middle of nowhere, knowing the Argentines may be somewhere up there. And I shouted to Michael Rose next to me, over the noise of the engine, I shouted, "Well, what happens if the RGs start hitting the landing zone?" And he leaned over and laughed, and he said, "Oh, well, who dares wins." Bloody difficult to be frightened when people say things like this in the middle of... And when we did land, there was actually a firefight going on. And again, if you don't know what's going on, and you suddenly pile out of a helicopter in the dark, and this icy mountain up nowhere, and you see all this tracer going all over the thing, again, I mean, I was about as scared as I possibly could be. and I just ran and cowered behind a rock until the helicopters disappeared. But eventually everything calmed down. And again, when you're with these guys, the SAS and Royal Marines, they are so sure of themselves, and they're so sure that they know what they're doing, that it's very difficult to stay scared oneself. And I, you know, I came to adore it in the moments when I wasn't. I mean, I think that next night on Mount Kent, when I couldn't sleep while I was shivering so much, I mean, when I was just lying there all night, and dawn, I was so bloody grateful when dawn came, at least you could brew up. And everybody had been in the same boat, just shivering all night. But these were great people, and it was wonderful to be with them. And gradually you realised we were much better than the other side, that the Royal Marines and the Paras are the best in the world at this, and to be with them in these places was terrific.
And so you obviously formed quite close relationships with the soldiers out there. How easy was it then for you to report in partial or neutral fashion?
I don't think I'd have pretended to be impartial. I was criticised by some people after the war was over for having been too gung-ho and having been too jingoistic in my reporting. But this was Britain's war, and, you know, most places one is, you can take a reasonably detached view, but when you're with a task force like that on the far side of the world fighting against the odds, I felt, well, after it's all over, we can have a good argument about whether the war was a good idea. This minute, these are our guys, I'm with them, I want our side to win. But it is fair to say that some people were bitterly critical of some of my reporting after the war, because they said, I put, you know, my heart was on my sleeve too obviously, and I lost my impartiality as a reporter. But when you were that cold and that scared, you do tend to lose your impartiality. One of the things very moving, in our normal lives at home, we lead on the whole pretty selfish lives. We're all fighting for a seat on the bus or the tube, and we're all fighting to get the job or to get the this, that and the other. What's so moving in the middle of a war like that is that everybody's trying to help each other, and suddenly there you are. You know, they want to try and help you to get a ride on a helicopter to get somewhere, that people you've never met in your life before were all together in some purpose. And one morning, I come back from the middle of the island to San Carlos, and I'd hitched a ride on a landing craft back out to the command ship Fearless so I could send a dispatch. And I was sitting absolutely exhausted, filthy dirty, shivering with a cold on the deck of this landing craft, and a head popped out of one of the hatches, and a Royal Marine said, you look a bit miserable and hungry. He said, would you like some bacon and eggs? And I said, God, I'd be absolutely ecstatic. And he suddenly, hand came out of the hatch, and he handed me a plate of bacon and eggs. And I felt so unbelievably grateful and so moved that this guy I'd never seen in my life before, he just wanted to help. He wanted to be. And I felt even more moved a few days later when that landing craft was sunk by Argentine aircraft and they were all killed. And you've got to be a funny sort of human being when you're living at that close quarters, whether you're a professional reporter or whatever. You've got to be a pretty funny sort of human being not to identify with these guys and to want our side to win.
There was controversy the other way. There was opposition to some reporters who did report the war, or, for example, like the BBC were trying to report it quite neutrally. Do you think they went too far in trying to be impartial?
I was down there and I wasn't here, so you can't. I don't think it's not that easy for me to comment because I was at the other side of the world. You never know what the British public mood's going to be, and one thing that's very interesting is that nobody now says, oh, it's wrong to be impartial in reporting the war in Afghanistan. Almost every day there's criticism of the campaign we're conducting in Afghanistan. I've been very critical, not of the soldiers, but critical of the manner in which it's being done. The British public doesn't feel engaged. Somehow, the Falklands, it was such an incredibly old-fashioned imperial venture that everybody absolutely literally started waving the Union Jack again. And the Falklands factor was something one of the things I'm going to say in the film I'm making now is maybe this was the last really popular war Britain will ever fight, because everybody could see the case. These are islands that belong to us. A lot of foreigners have gone and invaded them, and we've got to chuck them out. Everybody could understand it, and they could also understand what winning meant. That we all knew that what we had to do to win was just to get to Port Stanley, and after that it was all over. Well, of course, with Afghanistan, part of the tragedy is the troops out there call a lot of their operations mowing the lawn, because they go out there to a given place once every couple of weeks, and they clear out the Taliban and maybe have a firefight with them, and then 2 weeks later they've got to go back and do it again, just as if you were mowing the lawn. And winning, defining what is victory or defeat, is very difficult, and it goes on and on for years. But the Falklands War had only lasted 6 weeks, so I'm bound to say that those of us who were down there, it seemed a damn sight longer.
And do you think part of the reason why the British public seemed in the hole to support the war was because the Argentine government was a kind of right-wing dictatorship rather than, say, a democratic government like Britain?
The Argentine government, it was a horrible military dictatorship which had been oppressing its own people for many years and murdering its own people for many years. So, but the Falkland Islanders, they spoke our language, they were our sort of people. Whereas, you know, to have all these foreigners who speak Spanish on the islands, it was pretty easy to empathise with the Falklanders, and pretty easy not to empathise with the Argentine. Although the curious thing was, I mean, they live in a dream world, Argentines, that they never quite belong to the same universe as the rest of us. Their invasion was almost a sort of fantasy action. They just never really believed that we would see it differently and fight. And again, it was so weird when I was interviewing all these prisoners, and they kept saying, we never thought you were serious, and we never wanted to fight you. Quite extraordinary.
How legitimate do you think the Argentine claim was to the islands?
There is a sort of battiness about Britain maintaining islands, this tiny community at vast cost, on the other side of the world, over all these years. In that, for example, we quite ruthlessly expelled the entire population of Diego Garcia in the middle of the Indian Ocean to make way for an American air base, and we thought absolutely nothing about chucking out the unfortunate islanders in order to suit our own convenience. But the Falkland Islanders, somehow, we've got sentimental about them. And no British government now, while the Falkland generation is still alive, would dare hand them over or negotiate to hand them over to the Argentines, to Argentina. But it is amazing that you know, we readily handed over Hong Kong and goodness knows what else. But we have fought a war to preserve the Falklands with this tiny population. But I don't know, it's the way that history turns out. It may be illogical, but it's the way the British people feel very strongly about it. And the Argentines haven't helped themselves much, in that if they'd been smart, they would have been wooing the Falkland Islanders like mad. And of course, ironically, I mean, I forget somebody worked out the number. We could afford it to offer, the British government could have afforded to offer the Falkland Islanders about £10 million each to either go away or accept Argentine sovereignty. But logic sometimes in human affairs, it doesn't play any part. And the way things are now, the Argentines have gone on making threatening noises, and indeed are still making threatening noises now about possibly taking back the islands. And we've all got trapped in a situation where it's very difficult for either the British government, for the British government, to take any different position. We'll probably have to go on spending whatever it is, 70 or 80 million a year on defending the Falklands till the end of time, the way things are at the moment. And especially if oil's discovered them. Because Britain having spent all these billions there, I don't think it would be very popular in Britain if we then simply gave them to the Argentines when oil turns up there, if oil turns up there.
If, let's say, the Argentines invaded the Falklands again, do you think Britain would go to war again to defend them?
I don't think Britain would have any choice. And I know that the Ministry of Defence and the Chiefs of Staff take very seriously contingency plans for responding to any aggressive action by the Argentines. So I think we'd have to do it. But it would be, it would obviously be much easier to defend the Falklands now, because we've got this huge, very expensive airfield that we've created out there. And the airfield makes it easier to reinforce. You can move troops in there quickly, which of course you couldn't do back in 1982, because there was no airfield.
So you wouldn't have to send a big naval task force again?
Well, I don't mean it would be a hell of a business to fight another war down there, but it would be easier to mount a defence.
And so going back to the war itself, do you remember what the experience of victory was like when you were there?
The sheer sense of exultation. The thing is, when wars are going on, I mean, I had a moment of pure fun while I was on my way down to the Falklands, because I promised my wife after Vietnam ended, and when I left Saigon from the American embassy in April 1975, and I promised her I'd stop going to wars, and I'd been to 11 wars and I'd never been scratched. And I suddenly got a bit emotional after a couple of drinks on my way down to the Falklands, and I thought, my God, I pushed my luck too far, having got away with all these other wars and having said I'd stop being a war correspondent, it's just going to be one war too many. And I really started getting quite nervous about the notion that this would be the one I didn't come back from. And every man who, or every woman for that matter, who goes to a war, unless you're frightfully stupid, you do think about the possibility that you may get killed. And the fact that when it's over and you find you haven't been killed, one is so absolutely euphoric. You're so thrilled. And we'd won. You know, we'd done something really well. After the 1970s had been a dreadful decade for everybody living in Britain, and my generation, we were all resigned to almost permanent British decline. And now, suddenly, here we found was something that we'd done really well. We knew we'd done it well. We knew that the Royal Navy and the British Army had, you know, run this very difficult, tough campaign really well, and we'd won.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
That was Sir Max Hastings. The Falklands Legacy will be available to watch on BBC iPlayer until this Sunday night. You can read more about his time in the Falklands in the April issue of BBC History magazine. Max's latest book is All Hell Let Loose, The World at War, 1939-45. There's information about that at his website, maxhastings.com. Now we have a short advert.
Lord Strange was the fifth Earl of Derby, cousin of Elizabeth I, and a beacon of hope for Catholics. His death was shrouded in suspicion, and one of the biggest stories of the time. Now in his compelling new thriller, Traitor, award-winning writer Rory Clements delves into the truth of what happened.
He was a target for the Jesuits who thought he had wronged them. He was a target for people on the Privy Council who saw him as a threat. He was a target for the King of Scotland who saw him as a rival for the throne.
As England lies under the threat of a second Armada, intelligencer John Shakespeare must unravel a plot that points to treachery at the highest reaches of Elizabeth's government and sheds light on a fascinating mystery.
And I think I might have just stumbled on the truth of what really happened to Lord Strange.
Traitor by Rory Clements, out now in bookshops nationwide.
Our next interviewee is Dr. Helen Parr, a lecturer at Keele University. She has been researching the impact of the Falklands War on the soldiers, their loved ones, and the British population at large. I caught up with her to find out more. Okay, so first of all, can I ask you, what inspired you to start researching this conflict?
Well, I suppose, to be honest, what inspired me to start researching the conflict is the fact that my uncle was killed in the Falklands. So he was a 19-year-old private in Tupara, and he was killed at Wireless Ridge on the last day of the war. So although I was a child at the time, I was 7 years old, I was always very aware of the impact that it had on my own family, particularly on my grandparents, on my uncle's parents. So I kind of grew up with that, although, you know, it's one step removed from me, but I was just very aware of the impact that it had on my family. And as a result, I've always been interested in the Falklands, and with it being kind of 30 years now, it seemed like a good time to start researching it properly and to start sort of trying to talk to other families and veterans and so forth, and to build a kind of more complete picture of what the impact of the war was.
And so the focus of your research is very much on the impact of the people involved. It's not like a military history or anything like that.
Well, what I'm doing is writing a social history of the Falklands War. And what that means is, what I want to do is look at what it was like for the people who were involved in it or who were affected by it. So that means kind of looking at what it was like for combatants. So while I'm not writing a kind of a high military history, I'm trying to access what the experience was like for the people who were involved with it, and also to look at what it was like on the home front, if we can use those words, sort of what it was like for their families, and what it was like after the war. Because I think sort of one of the quite striking things about the Falklands is it exhibits as a kind of national event because it's got this very compelling narrative to it. So it's a short war. It only lasts for 74 days. It has a really clear origin. The Argentinians invade the Falkland Islands. Then the British dispatch a task force. It's got this kind of clear middle. There's a fighting war. And then it's got a really decisive end. The British win. And I think to look at what happens to individuals and also to look at what happens at home kind of challenges that easy narrative a little bit and sort of blurs the boundaries between this sort of theatre of war and what's going on domestically, and also extends the time frame of the war to look at kind of, it has an aftermath, although it has this kind of compelling sort of fits into quite a short time frame, but it has this long tail, and I think it sort of it blurs it a bit to look at that.
And from your research, what have you discovered about the impact of the war on the people who fought it?
Well, I have to say, I'm in the early stage of the research, so I haven't yet begun to do interviews. That's what I'd like to go on to do next. But I've been doing a lot of reading, looking at the memoirs that have been written and the interview material that's available. There's a lot of material available. And I think, I mean, the obvious thing to say about the impact on people who fought in it is that it varies a lot. But I think that it's kind of, it's It's a very intense experience for the people who actually have to go out there and fight in it. So 28,000 servicemen go. The average age, at least of the soldiers, is 19. So on the whole, I mean, there are kind of older members in the Merchant Navy and the Navy and so forth, but on the whole, they're young men and they're actually really excited. There hasn't been a war for 30 years and they're excited when they go to the Falklands. They're excited to fight this battle. And it's a short war, as I just said, but although the land battles occupy quite a small time frame, sort of kind of 5 days really, they're very intense. The fighting is very intense. There's hand-to-hand fighting with bayonets, and it's a very extreme experience. But I should say as well that, I mean, the majority of the servicemen who are killed are actually killed on the ships when the ships are bombed. So if you think about the kind of having had this really extreme experience, even for servicemen coming back who haven't been injured or who kind of come back fully intact, it's still a difficult adjustment to make. I mean, Lance Corporal Vincent Bramley, in his memoirs, he recalls that sort of after the fighting, when they're in Stanley, they can't adjust to being in a domestic environment. They've got so used to sleeping in the freezing cold in the open, they have to leave all the windows open. And obviously that's sort of quite a trivial point, but it's sort of symptomatic of this wider unease they feel about domestic comforts and the triviality that they sort of now associate with domestic life. And I think it's very difficult to reintegrate. Most of them sort of say, you know, they can't wait to get back off their leave and see their mates again. So what they kind of consider as normal has become blurred. But for servicemen who come back with a disability, it's obviously a very profound experience, a difficult experience. And I think sort of one thing that one derives from the memoirs is there's a sense that veterans have that they're now dispensable by a system that they've kind of given everything for. So John and Robert Lawrence's memoir, for example, is very interesting. So Robert Lawrence was badly injured on Tumbledown, and his father was they describe themselves as being a forces family. And the book is really about the father kind of coming to terms with the fact that of his son's disability or injury. And even he kind of talks about this lack of recognition for what his son has achieved. And he's aware that if he finds it difficult, then for people at sort of lower ranks who are less well connected, it must be extremely difficult to adjust in the aftermath.
What kind of assistance did the returning soldiers get from the government?
Well, that's an interesting question, really, because, I mean, one of the main things or one of the main kind of things that returning servicemen are angry about is that they often feel that they aren't given adequate assistance to adjust in the aftermath. Again, there's this sort of pervasive sense that they've done their worth. They've used up what worth they had, and the army isn't as interested in them in the aftermath. That's not universal, I have to say. Some of them do sort of talk kindly about the army in the aftermath, but a lot of them don't. And one of the most sort of striking examples is the anger that some returning veterans feel about post-traumatic stress disorder or battle shock. So those of them who come back who are experiencing some kind of trauma, that they're not given any assistance in identifying or kind of coming to terms with trauma. In 2002, about 2,000 veterans go to court, not just from the Falklands, but from subsequent conflicts as well, actually take the MOD to court to argue that the MOD should have done more to help them to identify the symptoms of trauma. And they lose the case, in fact, because it's very difficult to prove that there's been systematic neglect, which is what they're trying to show. But they certainly feel angry that more should have been done to kind of alert them to the possibility that there might be trauma. Because I think the symptoms of PTSD are extremely distressing for people who experience them. And before they know what it is, it's very, very difficult to deal with. And it makes it very, very, very hard for them. They kind of, they have terrible flashbacks or nightmares, or sort of living flashbacks where they physically experience or re-experience things that have happened to them. But before they know what's happening to them, it kind of exhibits as they're being kind of angry, uncontrolled, vulnerable young men. They often it often goes with sort of alcohol or substance abuse and so forth. Once they get diagnosis, then they can begin to kind of move on from it. But the fact is that they don't feel that they're given help in getting that diagnosis.
Was the government better at helping those who'd come back from the war wounded?
It's difficult to say, to be honest. It's quite mixed what people say about it. I mean, for example, Simon Weston, whose memoirs are very well known, who was a Welsh Guardsman who was on the Sir Galahad when the Sir Galahad was bombed. He speaks very highly of the Welsh Guards and how actually it helped him a great deal. He goes sort of on a trip with the Welsh Guards afterwards, and it kind of helps him to sort of to re-establish his sort of sense of identity in a way. But other people don't speak so. Other people feel more dispensed with. I think that there isn't really a role for them in the army after if they come back with a disability, and they find that difficult to come to terms with.
What kind of impact was it on the families of those who died in the war or those who were injured?
Well, again, I mean, the impact is obviously very varied, but I think it seems like an obvious thing to say, but I think it's probably quite important to say it, is that the impact is also very considerable. So it has a very serious impact on people who have a loved one who's been injured or killed. I mean, even if combatants come back with no injury, as I said at the beginning, yeah. It's often quite difficult to kind of to reintegrate. And I guess, you know, for a family that's been waiting at home for a serviceman to come back, then no doubt they're proud of what their loved one has done. But they can't treat them as a hero on a day-to-day basis. You've got to kind of get on with it and come back and kind of absorb this normality. And I think even that is quite difficult for people to adjust to. But where there's been an injury, sort of either a physical or an injury connected with trauma, it's often a really huge transformation. And families report kind of practical issues. For example, if a serviceman is in a hospital, which is some distance from where you live, families have to kind of spend money and take time to visit the serviceman in hospital. Sometimes they have to give up their jobs because they just don't. It's just very difficult to kind of find the time to make those visits. Sort of obvious points about returning servicemen who have disabilities, adjustments have to be made for their mobility, and you know if you're married to a serviceman and you live in service accommodation, if they can no longer serve, then you have to move house. So it kind of it affects people's whole sense of who they are and what their kind of role is. It's quite interesting, I suppose, that the generation of service wives in the early 1980s, they generally do have their own careers, so they're not kind of reliant on their husbands for all of their status or anything. But as I said, some of them have to give up work to take on a caring role, some of them have to move house, or some of them, I guess, end up becoming the main breadwinner. And that sort of could be an adjustment in how people think of themselves and think of their roles in their family and in society more widely. Anecdotally, at least, it's quite common that there's relationship breakdowns in the aftermath of the war, although, again, anecdotally, lots do reacquaint afterwards. But it's quite clear that it's a sort of period of adjustment and some sort of dislocation.
And were the families or the other loved ones of those who died or injured, were they offered support from the armed forces or the government?
Well, again, it's hard to say it's sort of in its entirety, but certainly the feeling that one gets from reading interviews with families that are done in the immediate aftermath is that they feel that they're not a priority. And that's kind of, I think that's quite important. So this is something which has a tremendous impact on individual lives, but families sort of feel that now that, you know, if a serviceman is dead or is injured and can no longer serve, that they're just not a priority. So nobody really kind of cares or takes an interest in what they're going through. And you can illustrate that sort of looking at how information about casualties is handled. And on the whole, it sort of seems that the provision of information to families is not terribly well handled at all. And I guess in a way, it's kind of obvious. I mean, the Navy hasn't had to deal with this since the Second World War, so they don't really have procedures in place. The Army do have procedures because of Northern Ireland, but even so, they're quite overwhelmed by the sort of numbers of casualties that happen in a short space of time. And so there's plenty of examples where families are kind of left not knowing what's happened to their family member for a day or two. For example, the news of the sinking of the HMS Sheffield is first heard on the radio, and then families are kind of left to ring up to try to find out whether their kind of loved one has survived or not. And in one or two cases, false information is given. When the HMS Coventry is sunk, the Defence Secretary, John Knott, just announces that one ship has been sunk, which, as you can imagine, kind of sends families into a terrible period of just not quite knowing what's happened. And similarly, when the Sir Galahad is sunk, again, there's lots of examples of families just finding it difficult to get hold of information. And some of them report that it's this not knowing, which is the worst period of their life. And it can take sort of 2 to 3 days for accurate information to come through. And again, I mean, there's examples as well as who gives the news to families varies quite a lot. So in some examples, it's the wife of a senior army member who lives in the camp. In other examples, it's a padre or a chaplain or a welfare officer. And I mean, sometimes the news is given sensitively, but other times it doesn't seem to have been given terribly sensibly. One widow was 6 months pregnant, and she receives the news just on her doorstep. And families also sort of feel that information isn't given. So the parents of Private Jason Burt, for example, who are interviewed in Jean Carr's book, in the immediate aftermath, Jason Burt was the youngest soldier to die in the Falklands. And they really want to know exactly how he died, but they're not told, although they ask, and they're not told until the soldiers come back subsequently. The soldiers who served with him come and tell them, but the sort of senior members of the army don't give them that information. So I think families feel like they're just not a priority, which in a way you can understand. They're obviously not. The army's engaged in fighting a war, but it obviously makes a big difference to people to feel like that nobody really cares about this terrible thing that's happened to them.
After the people had been killed in the Falklands, what was the process of repatriating their bodies?
I suppose it's controversial in a sense because it's the first time that bodies are repatriated from a combat zone, at least in Britain. I should say that the majority of servicemen that are buried at sea, 174 are buried at sea because they were on the ships that were bombed. But of those who aren't, 64 bodies are repatriated. So most families want the bodies to be brought home from the combat zone. And that's a quite interesting comment on how they view the war, perhaps. Of those who choose to have the bodies buried in the Falklands, 14 bodies are buried in a cemetery in the Falkland Islands, and 2 are buried at the actual location where they were killed. And for example, Sarah Jones, the widow of Colonel H. Jones, who wins the VC at Goose Green, she argues that H. Jones would want to be buried with his men, kind of near to where he fell. But for most families, I think, for those who kind of want the bodies to be brought home, and there's a rapid campaign builds up to repatriate the bodies, and it's resolved fairly quickly. I don't think it's a very difficult decision for the government to take to allow the bodies to be repatriated. And I think families feel that, well, you know, a lot of the men who were killed were quite young. They've obviously spent much more time at home, and they want to be sort of, they should be laid to rest where they grew up. families want to be able to tend graves. And again, to sort of draw on the testimony of the parents of Private Jason Burt, who was only 17 when he was killed, they argue very strongly in 1982 that he shouldn't have been there. He was too young to be sent to war. He was too young to be sent to Northern Ireland. So why was he sent to the Falklands? And for that reason, they want him home. And of the bodies that are repatriated, again, 18 are buried at the military cemetery in Aldershot, but most are buried locally in a place of the family's choosing. And I think that what that shows is, again, it's a small war. The numbers involved are not huge, but the people who have experienced bereavement are quite isolated. And it's clear that, you know, there are sort of some small communities in Hereford, for example, where most of the SAS men's families live. 18 SAS men were killed, and most of their families live in Hereford or in Glamorgan, where a lot of the Welsh guards are from. But on the whole, sort of families are kind of left to deal with it, much as any other bereaved family would have to deal with it. They're dealing with it alone and relying on kind of traditional sources of support, and it leaves people in quite an isolated position, I think, in the aftermath of the war.
And so what was the longer-term impact on a family that had lost a loved one?
Well, again, I mean, as with injury, it's kind of, it has a tremendous impact on families. I mean, my father remembers thinking, after he'd heard the news that his brother had been killed, he remembers driving home and thinking that nothing will ever be the same again. And I think that that's true. I mean, this is something that just can't be undone. And so families have to kind of, have to come to terms with it however they can. And it's interesting that in this collection of interviews by Jean Carr that are done in the immediate aftermath, the focus is very much on mothers. It's on widows as well, but it's mainly on mothers. And I think there's a sense in which mothers kind of experience this ultimate form of grief. And some of the mothers actually say that themselves, sort of bearing in mind that when they're interviewed in 1982, it's still very, very raw. They kind of argue that, well, the wives can get a new husband, but you can't replace a child. But it's kind of interesting, I think, that the focus on mothers in some ways distracts from thinking about fathers. And I found absolutely nothing about the impact or the grief that fathers experience. I mean, some fathers, again, from the sort of testimony that's available in the soldiers' memoirs, some fathers have had a more distant role in their sons' upbringings, but no doubt the grief for them is still very, very real. And it's often the case that fathers have encouraged their sons to go into the military. And just as a sort of an example of that, the dedication that my grandfather wrote on the wreath that he placed on my uncle's grave, "To my hero son from your broken-hearted dad." And I think that probably sort of encapsulates something which a lot of fathers do feel, but their grief is sort of overlooked by thinking about how it affects the mothers, who are perhaps better equipped perhaps to talk about the grief and to talk about how it affects them. So I suppose the point is that it has bereavement has an enormous impact on families that it does affect, and how people come to terms with that sort of differs a great deal.
Was there any kind of sense of guilt of some parents if they'd encouraged a child to go into the armed services and then they were killed?
I don't know. I mean, again, I think it varies a lot. I've seen some sort of testimony on the internet where sort of families have kind of come from an army family or families with a sort of history of service. And I don't think they do feel guilt, really. And what a lot of families say is, well, our son was sort of doing a job that he loved. And so they recognise that even though they've paid this terrible price, that they couldn't really have stopped their child from doing it because it was what they wanted to do. And therefore, somehow, I think I haven't found evidence that they actually feel guilty. It doesn't mean that they don't, but I think lots of families articulate it in this way, that the child was doing, or the husband was doing, a job that he loved, and they couldn't actually have stopped him from doing that job, even though they miss him enormously.
And on the sort of the wider nation as a whole, how were the dead commemorated?
Well, I think, again, it kind of goes back to what I said about the beginning, at the beginning about the Falklands being a sort of national event. And I think one of the interesting things about it is that it is commemorated as an event, partly because it can be. I mean, many more soldiers are killed in Northern Ireland in the 1970s, for example, but it's much more difficult to commemorate that as an actual event. But the Falklands, sort of, because it has this sort of narratable structure, it can be commemorated, and it is commemorated. And sort of it's implicit in your question, really, but the commemoration is contested. And one of the interesting questions to ask is who is the commemoration for? So, for example, there's a memorial service at St. Paul's Cathedral in July 1982, so sort of soon afterwards. And Margaret Thatcher very much sees this as being a celebration of the liberation of the islands and remembrance of the fallen. But the Archbishop of Canterbury wants the emphasis to be on peace and reconciliation. And eventually they have to compromise and they just call it the Falkland Islands Service. And this kind of this contest kind of continues. And in October, they have a march and a march past and a fly past in the City of London. And one of the areas of debate is that initially disabled veterans are excluded from the march past, but after pressure in the House of Commons, they're permitted to take part. And it's very interesting if you watch footage of the march past right at the beginning. The TV journalist Anthony Burnett is talking to the army's PR person who they've got present, and Anthony Burnett says, "Oh well, this is a victory parade." And the army's PR person said, "Well, yes, we have to recognise the fact that it is a victory, and we have to be proud of that. But I prefer to see it as saluting the task force. So it's kind of recognising the achievement that the individuals have made, and kind of muting this idea that it's a celebration of a national victory. But obviously, the two things kind of blur a little bit." And I think that kind of picks up on some sort of ambivalence that families feel in the aftermath. I mean, some families obviously support the sacrifice that has been made for the liberty of the Falkland Islands and argue that this is a war for freedom, but others think it's a pointless war. Their kind of political views on the point of the Falklands vary. But I think what probably unites families is the pride in what their family members or their loved ones have done for the job that they have done, and to that extent, even if they don't fully support the war, they recognise or at least accept that they would like some kind of recognition, public recognition of the achievement that the task force has made. So in that sense, it's kind of commemoration is a kind of recognition for what their loved ones have achieved.
You're researching the project at the moment. What kind of outcomes are you hoping for from it?
That's a good question. I think what I'm kind of hoping to do is I think sort of focusing on individual experience and looking for sort of stories that haven't been told. I mean, there's a lot of material already available about the Falklands War, but the kind of the what's going on at home, it has not been nearly as extensively investigated. And I think that looking at sort of individual experience and looking at what it's like for the families and looking at the kind of aftermath of the war, it helps to kind of complicate this simple national narrative of a beginning and a middle of an end, because it sort of it blurs the boundaries between the combat zone and what's going on at home. And it sort of shows that, you know, soldiers go and in the combat zone they're soldiers, but when they come home they're fathers, their sons, their husbands. So it kind of it looks at how people navigate those roles, and it kind of it creates a sort of fuller picture, I think, of what the effects of the war are. Because obviously it's a small war, doesn't actually affect, you know, that many people overall. But nevertheless, it still does have a tremendous impact on those who it does affect. And I think that kind of enables you to draw a sort of a fuller picture of what it means to prosecute a small war in the contemporary era, if you like.
That was Helen Parr of Keele University. Well, that's all for this week. Please let us know what you thought of this episode on Twitter, Facebook, or email podcast@historyextra.com. As I mentioned earlier, BBC History Magazine is now available for the Kindle and for the iPad. Check us out on the Amazon website and the Apple newsstand, respectively. Do tune in next week, where our editor Dave Musgrove will be talking Romans, and I'll be finding out whether Shakespeare gave Richard II a fair crack of the whip. The History Extra weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced, as always, by Dave Gibson.